Hi, welcome to China Unscripted, the only podcast starring me, Chris Chappell. I'm alone, as all people are. Ultimately, we all face death by ourselves.
Thank you, Werner Herzog.
Oh my gosh, I'm not alone. So, typically in an introduction, people introduce themselves. So let's try again.
The problem was you said the only podcast starring Chris Chappell, and then what was I supposed to say?
And Shelley Jung.
And I have problems with the word starring. I think that's what happened.
Okay. Hello, this is China Unscripted. I am Chris Chappell.
And I'm Shelley Jung.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
So, we have just gotten back from a wonderful week in Norway for the Oslo Freedom Forum. The Oslo Freedom Forum is a human rights event where speakers from around the world come and discuss the state of democracy in the world. Is that how you guys would describe it?
Everyone there is, in some way or another, standing up to an authoritarian, oppressive regime.
Mm-hmm. In my case, it's you. But in other cases, it's, you know, Iran or China or...
Russia or Eritrea, or Yemen.
Togo. I mean,
there's a lot of countries where things are not doing... You know what I liked is I felt really good about America by comparison.
I mean, when you compare the United States to some of the worst oppressive regimes in the world, we definitely come out smelling like roses. Yeah, it was interesting. The Oslo Freedom Forum started off with a press conference, and there was this reporter who was very insistent on saying, like, don't you guys consider the United States an authoritarian regime? And that was apparently not the thing to say to a panel of people who are from, like...
North Korea, and who else was...
Gary Kasparov was there, so he had the Russia angle. I think he was the one who said, like, you know, in your country, if you upset the president, or if you say something bad about the president, he'll write an angry tweet. In my country, if you say something about the president, you won't make it home that night.
Yeah, there's a slight difference between the two. And I have noticed that people, you know, in the comments to some of our videos, like, people want to immediately kind of knee-jerk attack America. When we're talking about, for example, the Chinese government building these islands in the South China Sea, and then someone will be like, well, America has military bases around the world, as if that's an equivalent thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's only on the very surface. Like, there's no thought to, like, the motivations behind these kind of things. Or the fact that the United States, the government, is ultimately answerable to the people. Whereas authoritarian regimes, well, they also answer to the people, and the people are always in full support of their loving leaders.
Until one day, perhaps they're not.
Dun, dun, dun. So other than intense patriotic pride, what did you guys get from the Oslo Freedom Forum? How did it make you feel?
You feel inspired and also really depressed at the same time.
It is an odd combination of feelings. Like, there's hope, but oh my gosh, there's so many horrible things happening.
Yeah, I mean, you see a lot of the people talking about the same thing happening over and over in different parts of the world, and it's very similar how authoritarian regimes operate, regardless of whatever ideology or things behind them. Like, when there was the one, like, 16-year-old Afghani girl who was part of that robotics team that sent a robot to the U.S., and at first they were denied visas, but then after, like, an intense, like, public campaign, they were allowed to get visas to go into the U.S. and watch their, you know, robots compete in this robotics competition. And then after she went home, she was talking about how her dad was one of her biggest supporters, and then her dad was killed by ISIS. And then one of her neighbors told her that if she hadn't gotten an education and gone to compete in this robotics competition, her father would still be alive.
Yeah, it was her fault.
Yeah, and that was so messed up, but also exactly what happens in China under the Communist Party, where people start to blame the people for, oh, like, it's your fault because you said something against, like, you tried to get, you know, justice from the government, like, you, like, you're yeah. this nail that stood out, so of course you're going to be hammered.
Why should you be any different? It's a horrible process. What about you, Matt? What struck you?
That there are just a lot of people out there doing things to stand up to authoritarian regimes. Like, for example, there's a show running out of Venezuela called the Bipolar Capybara, and they do a show that's like a satirical news show about what's happening in Venezuela. But they're doing it from Caracas. And I was thinking, like, you know, we do our show about China from New York. These guys are doing a show about Venezuela from Venezuela. And that takes a lot of guts. So I admired them. And I admired a lot of the different people who, you know, speak out about the authoritarian regimes and then are in that country. Now, nobody from, like, China or North Korea doing that. But certainly some other countries. So, mad props to them.
I think one of the greatest things I felt about being at the Oslo Freedom Forum is that I felt in a way like they were our people in a certain sense. I don't know how to describe it exactly, but, you know, when we kept talking to people and meeting people, it was like, here are a bunch of people who are in different ways trying to either stand up to authoritarian regimes or, like, shed light on some of the things that are happening in their parts of the world. And I guess after doing China Uncensored for so many years, it was pretty cool to meet other people who are doing the same thing in different ways or very similar ways, like with the Bipolar Capybara. Like, you felt like it was actually, these things do reach people and have an effect.
So yeah, there were really a lot of brave, incredible people there. And then, you know, I was speaking on the Dark Side of Tech panel, a panel discussion about how authoritarian regimes use technology to oppress people, and, you know, so make some jokes.
Sunshine and flowers is what you're saying.
Basically, or at least Winnie the Pooh.
That's true. Lots of honey. I think it went pretty well, actually. Like, there were about 200 people there at the panel.
Yeah. So I guess what surprised me after that is, you think of, like, these human rights defenders as, you know, these very staunch, serious people. And then you realize, oh, no, they're normal people who like to laugh and have a good time, just like anyone else.
Yeah. One time I met David Kilgore, and he's, like, a former Canadian MP who's spent the last, like, 10 years doing research onto forced organ harvesting in China. And I was really shocked when I met him that he was, like, laughing, like, he just, like, this incredible sense of humor. And I'm like, you know, Mr. Kilgore, I expected you to be much more serious. He's like, if I were a serious person, I couldn't do this. You need a sense of humor to be able to deal with all this heavy stuff.
No wonder we're so good at it.
I think a lot of people deal with it in different ways. One of the things they talked about at the forum was definitely about the fact that activists need to also take care of themselves.
There were a lot of people dealing with trauma on different levels.
Yeah, and actually one of the coolest speeches to me was this one Egyptian activist talking about, he had this thing about his notes to self about what he learned from becoming an accidental activist. Mm-hmm. Because he was just tweeting about Tahrir Square, and then he became suddenly this famous activist, and then felt like he had to somehow live up to this, and then went through this period of depression and realized a bunch of things, like, you have to remember why you're doing this, that, you know, just getting your voice out there isn't the final, you know, thing that you should be aiming for, and things like, you know, you have to listen to the other side. It was a really good speech, actually.
Yeah, you mentioned being an accidental activist. I think a lot of people that we met at the Oslo Freedom Forum were, in many ways, accidental activists. People who, like, didn't ask for this life, but, like, came upon some situation or were, like, put in prison for some reason or whatever, and they came out and they just, like, wanted to tell their story, and then it kind of became this thing where they represented an issue that they never intended to represent. And so, like, they're trying to deal with, like, their own lives, but they feel this need to speak out about it. And it's just like they never really wanted the life of being an activist. They just kind of, it happened to them.
Yeah, ordinary folk thrust into extraordinary circumstances. So anyone of you listening could someday be an accidental activist.
Hopefully not because you were put in prison for example, asking your calculus teacher to teach calculus instead of religious indoctrination in Iran.
Hopefully. I'm sure we're not having too many people in Iran listening to this.
You know, one of the things that I was surprised about at the Oslo Freedom Forum was a lot of people we talked to had a lot to say about China. Did you notice that?
Yeah, it was interesting how China plays a role in all these other horrible authoritarian regimes around the world.
Yeah, like even the director of the Oslo Freedom Forum said in the press conference, right, that he felt the biggest threats to freedom in the world today were Vladimir Putin and China.
One man and an entire country.
Yeah, so it was interesting. We interviewed somebody from Cambodia who had a lot to say about what China was doing, what the Chinese government was doing in Cambodia. And then we talked to somebody from Vanguard Africa, which does a lot of work in different African nations, and same issues, more or less.
Yeah, the common thread is the Chinese Communist Party, and they're actually behind a lot of these regimes, helping prop them up in many ways.
Yeah, and they have like a sort of plug-and-play censorship internet thing that they gave to Iran and like some other countries.
Yes, I think also Nicaragua. Like, it's interesting how far it spreads.
Yeah, Venezuela has a lot of Chinese the weapons and like riot gear that the police in Venezuela were using were from China. It's like, yeah, these little pieces of like China's authoritarian rule popping up in all these other authoritarian countries around the world.
Yeah, China's great at exporting.
Well, you mentioned, Shelley, the interview with Mu Sukua. Why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, Mu Sukua is a Cambodian opposition leader, and she was part of the government. She used to be a member of parliament before the current Prime Minister Hun Sen decided to, you know, dissolve the opposition party. Totally unrelated to the fact that people started marching in the streets, you know, against his rule. So she was speaking at the Oslo Freedom Forum, and then I met her at one of the, you know, receptions, and we started talking, and she had a lot to say about China. And
all good, I assume.
Yeah, fabulous if you're from the perspective of a wealthy Chinese businessman with connections to the Communist Party who now gets to bring your company to Cambodia, buy up lots of, you know, land, kick the farmers off, and build your luxury condos and casinos that you use to wreck the local economy while helping lots of wealthy Chinese launder their money out of China.
Well, that does describe me to a T.
Yes.
But that was the first interview you've actually conducted for China Uncensored, right?
Yeah, I was a little rusty. It's actually kind of funny how that happened. Because of scheduling reasons, we ended up having to do that interview at almost the same time that the fan meetup was happening. You know, I think the fans might have been disappointed if you didn't show up, Chris, for the fan meetup.
Well, at the fan meetup, everyone was just saying, "Where's Shelley? We only want Shelley."
Oh, then we made the wrong choice.
We made the wrong choice. Yeah, I mean the Oslo Freedom Forum was so busy. Everyone was doing so many things. So Mu Sukua showed up a little late, and so like we were actually getting ready to pack up and go to the fan meetup. She showed up at like just the last minute, so you were able to take over that interview, and I was able to go off and meet the fans.
So when people see the interview, just be gentle.
Yeah, oh, you did a great job, Shelley.
Well, she said some pretty amazing stuff, and then she invited us to Cambodia. And she was like, why don't you guys go there and report?
So Cambodia is under the oppressive thumb of the Chinese Communist Party, whom you guys criticize. Come to Cambodia.
Well, we were like, yeah, that sounds great. What were you saying about the Chinese gangs again?
You'll protect us, Matt, right?
Yes, but not if we go to Cambodia. I don't know if I'll be able to. I mean, you know, when we were doing, we did that Pivot to Asia tour in 2016, and we had like a whole bunch of countries on the potential list. We ended up going to the Philippines, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, only possibly one of which is a country, depending on your political view. But we had a bunch of other countries on the sort of short list, including Cambodia, including Vietnam, including Malaysia, and you know, we kind of pared it down for different reasons. Vietnam was mainly because there was too much danger of Chinese Communist Party influence. In other words, they could have their agents in Vietnam kidnap you. So likewise, Cambodia is also fairly risky.
I kind of want to go to Cambodia now, though.
I mean, I do, too. It's always this kind of weird balance between, like, how much risk are we willing to take on to do the reporting? And I think, you know, there is a degree of risk every time we travel. I mean, the South China Sea trip was not a particularly safe trip.
I mean, being on a rickety fishing boat for 57 hours?
I was more concerned about what would happen if the Chinese Coast Guard tried to board our ship.
Yeah.
Ship is a generous word for it, but yeah.
Yeah, I was actually reading something yesterday about how the Chinese Coast Guard has started taking the fishermen's catch, like the Filipino fishermen the Filipino fishermen who are in the Scarborough Shoal. Apparently they've been started being stopped by Chinese Coast Guard vessels who then take their fish.
Classy.
Yeah.
Like there are projects in Africa too, where they end up like stealing water from the locals.
Like my point was that, you know, we happened to go in like a weird ceasefire time when Duterte was just starting to be like, Xi Jinping is now my best friend. So if we had gone 2 weeks earlier, it could have been a very different situation with the Coast Guard vessels.
So I have a good idea. I think we can really cover a lot of interesting topics in like Cambodia and Vietnam, but you know, I can be like the man in the studio, and you guys can be the man and woman in the field, and like, you know, that'd be a pretty cool dynamic, I think.
So you're gonna send us to do a correspondent package?
I mean, it's brave of me to do that, but yes,
it's very generous of you, Chris, to let us have all the credit.
Yeah, you know, it shows that I don't care about myself.
Yes, you're very selfless, and also you share.
Yes. Well, Shell, you did have an idea about doing a package from South Africa.
Yes, but I'm sure South Africa's fine, right?
Speaking of Africa, what was the jam that we listened to the entire damn trip?
Well, okay, it wasn't the entire trip. It was only after, let's say, the second day when we were going to interview someone from Vanguard Africa. And we started talking about...
There was one of us in particular who kept talking about that Toto song, Africa.
Which one of us was that?
Boy, that person probably is really cool.
Uh-huh. And which person was it who thought the lyrics were, I'll miss the rains down in Africa?
Which makes more sense.
Yeah, I mean, it was both me and Chris.
That's
it was
true.
The rains.
It's like kissed by a rose on the gray. That's not what the lyrics should be, but that's what it is.
I mean, just out of curiosity, for those of you listening on YouTube, are the lyrics, I miss the rains down in Africa, or I bless the rains down in Africa?
What, write your answer below?
Yeah, write your answer below. Like, I want to know, because for like 30 years, I thought it was, I miss the rains down in Africa, because that makes sense. How could he bless the rains? Like, he does not have the Toto does not have the authority, having never been to Africa by the, you know, when he wrote the song, does not have the authority to bless those rains.
What I just learned from that is that you have been listening to Africa since you were in the cradle.
That's true.
Cradle of the grave, Toto.
But that song, I mean, we ended up listening to that like at least, you know, 10 times.
Well, because we found out Weezer just did a cover of that. And I mean, yeah. This is weird. Serious human rights conference, Toto.
Well, you have to have something to, you know,
lessen the
like
pressure.
Leaving the, yeah, like break yeah. the like terrible, terrible, awful feelings about the world.
Yes.
So apparently we found our escape.
Yeah, yeah.
In Yacht Rock.
Yacht Rock. I mean, yeah, you go listen to like Yeomni Park, North Korean defector, talking about trying to remember, did she watch her mom get raped once or twice? And it's like, okay, what do we do after that? Toto. Yeah, it's Bless the Rains in Africa. Boy, this is important, good stuff we're talking about now.
Yeah, well,
it
you know.
Goes back to the lesson of how do people deal with trauma.
Yeah. Oh, that was the other theme, I think, of the entire event was trauma.
Hope and trauma.
Everyone there, like, just dealt with so much. It's just incredible.
That's why they had the talk about using MDMA therapy.
What's MDMA?
Oh, Molly? Like...
Hmm?
Shell, you clearly know more about this than either
of
us.
Oh, my God. Okay, so the psychedelic drug, MDMA, like the, you know, the party drug.
So on this podcast, we've established you have the dirtiest mind and you also know the most about drugs.
Yeah.
I bless the rains down in Africa.
I bless the rains.
Okay, let's go back to talking about drugs now. Yeah.
So tell us more about these drugs to deal with trauma.
Actually, I can't because we missed that particular talk because we were doing an interview with Fong Jen at the time.
Ah, the other important interview we did. So the Tiananmen Square Massacre had its 29th anniversary.
Woo!
And so we got this interview with Fong Jung, who was in the square at the time. And early in the morning of June 4th, 1989... The tanks were rolling in, and he was trying to rescue. Like, the tanks showed up out of the smoke. He like pushed this girl over the barrier to save her from being crushed by the tanks. And he turned around, and the tank was right there and rolled over his legs. And so he was rushed to the hospital. They managed to save his life, but not his legs. And so he was in a wheelchair for the rest of his life.
And he had some stuff to say.
Yeah, well, one of which was that the Communist Party wanted him to lie and say that he lost his legs in a car accident.
Because he was a successful student athlete.
Yeah.
So it was a bit embarrassing that they had the star athlete who, had his career altered because of Communist Party tanks.
Well, so later when he, then he trained to be a discus thrower. So when he was competing in these like, Paralympic type games in China, they'd have to say like, what, you know, how did he lose his legs? And, you know, can you just say that it was a road accident?
That's technically true.
Oh, gosh, in the worst kind of way. Yeah, because his thing is that the Communist Party is always wants people to forget it ever happened. So he is a living testament that did happen.
Yeah, and I thought it was a great interview. If you haven't listened to the interview yet, you really should, because I feel like, you know, we've talked to several Tiananmen survivors. We interviewed one a few years ago at the Hong Kong Umbrella Movement. But I feel like Fong Jen really was very kind of clear about why Tiananmen Square, the Tiananmen Square Massacre is still important to talk about today. And how it still has an impact on modern China because of the way that the Communist Party tries to, you know, make everybody have amnesia about it. And he had a lot to say about memory as a form of resistance against the party, which I thought was pretty interesting as well.
And that's kind of interesting from the perspective of dealing with trauma, because you think a lot of what people, a way people would deal with that is by trying to forget what caused that trauma.
I do think that a lot of people in China do that, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people have been through a lot of trauma that they then kind of suppress and don't tell their children about, because they don't want their children to kind of know the suffering of the past. They want them to have a better life. But then, you know, you can't suppress that forever. It kind of comes out in all sorts of different, interesting, psychologically interesting ways.
I feel like you're speaking from experience here.
Are there stories there you want to share, or is that...
Well, I mean, you know, I think that for me, my parents didn't talk about the Cultural Revolution for a long time. Like, they didn't talk about the actual things that happened, so I didn't understand what it was.
Didn't you think the Cultural Revolution was, how did you put it?
Oh, I thought it was just like a time period. Like, you know, like if your parents said, like, you know, back in the 60s, we did blah, blah, blah. Like, I thought it was like during the Cultural Revolution, you know, like we were sent down to the countryside. Like, that's just something that is a part of growing up in China. You just go to the countryside to work for a couple years, because that's kind of the way my parents talked about it.
Did your parents bless the rains down in the countryside?
Not that I know of, because the Communist Party is atheist. I'm pretty sure the only person you were supposed to worship in the Cultural Revolution was Mao.
Did they bless Mao?
I think it was more about asking Mao to bless you through quoting his little red book. Oh, you know what Mao did bless? The mangoes.
Oh my gosh.
I remember you saying that your dad actually had seen one of the so-called Mao's mangoes as it passed through his village that he was sent to work at.
Yes. If you guys don't know about Mao's mangoes, Chris did an episode about it a few years ago. Yeah, it's one of the oldies but goodies for China Uncensored. But, you know, the Prime Minister of Pakistan had given Mao some mangoes, and then Mao had said, these mangoes are for the workers.
Mangoes not being a thing anyone had ever really seen in China.
So then, like, these mangoes were given to the different, like, work unit, like, different factories. And then the workers were like, these mangoes are for Mao. We cannot eat them. We must worship them. So they put them in, like, glass cases. And then the mangoes were paraded around, you know, the entire country, basically, to show people the mangoes that Mao's, like, you know, love had given to the people.
And there was propaganda artwork made about them. There were souvenirs.
It was crazy. Like, people would be, you know, you'd have, like, be eating off of enamel bowls and plates that had mangoes on them, or, like, sleeping.
A cigarette brand that had, like, mangoes on it. It was so, yeah.
There was
crazy.
A movie, like a propaganda movie that involved like marching the mangoes down the street. Like, it is
really,
yeah. Like, there was actually a few years ago at one of the China Institutes in New York City, they had a exhibit on Mao's mangoes. So I went, and Matt, you went too, right?
I went too. Yeah. I took some photos of it. It was amazing to see how much stuff had mango designs on it from that era.
I didn't realize at the time, because my dad had told me the story. That's how, you know, Chris, you and I first talked about doing it for China Uncensored. Mm-hmm. Like, my dad had told me the story of the mangoes, and how when he was a kid, he remembered, like, the entire village being like, oh my God, the mangoes are coming. And then going out to see the mango that they brought in like, this, like, glass case. And then, like, they paraded the mango around the village, and my dad, like, felt really, like, awed and inspired at the time. And then when he was older, he realized that was not an actual mango. It was a wax replica of the mangoes. That they had produced, like, hundreds or thousands of these wax replicas of the mangoes in these glass cases, and they, you know, would take them around everywhere, because obviously the real mangoes would eventually rot.
So smash priceless ancient Buddhist statues and relics, but worship papier-mâché mangoes.
Yes. Like, you know, because Mao said something about them.
And I think that's the kind of insanity that is so common in these authoritarian regimes. We heard someone speak from, I think it was Togo, the African nation Togo. not Toto, Togo, where the dictator there made people clap for him 4 times a day.
Was that Togo? Was that Eritrea?
Oh, it might have been Eritrea.
I can't. Which terrible African dictatorship was it?
Let's I know see. There was a couple
yeah.
that were talked about, and so they're kind of bleeding together.
She showed photos of people lining up in the street, and you'd have to clap.
And if you didn't, they'd kill you.
That's actually very similar to what the Kims did in North Korea, too.
Yeah. But, I mean, really, isn't Trump the worst?
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff that...
You don't say that at that kind of event.
No, I mean, it's just... I feel like that's almost, like, arrogant of yeah. that reporter to be like, oh, well, is it America? Like, I don't know if it was an American reporter, but, like, it's either, like, arrogant for Americans to think that we have it the worst, or it kind of, I don't know.
America is the greatest country in the world. We even have the greatest oppressive regime.
Yeah, but also, like, people forget to mention that Trump's going to be gone in a few years anyway, and someone else that voters like... will be in office, so you know, you have the same government with a new leader, you can just swap him out for someone that you like better. If you don't like him, go vote.
Yeah, basically voting is pretty important.
I like our checks and balances. It's much better to the mango worshiping clapping all the time alternatives.
I think that's one thing that Fang Zheng was talking about too when we interviewed him, that you know, at the time the students of Tiananmen Square like realized that they didn't want a personality cult, like they didn't want the kind of worship of Mao that had happened during the Cultural Revolution, but they still had a lot of faith in the Communist Party. Mm. Like they thought, you know, the party can lead us to the right way, like the party can reform. And then after the party literally crushed all of their hopes and dreams, he was saying that, you know, then they realized that you can't depend on a ruling party, you know, being good or whatever. Like, you have to have a system of government that works. So, you know, just today I was passing by this park in Brooklyn where somebody was buried who was a former Chief Justice of the New York State Supreme Court. And on the monument it said, you know, we are a country of laws, not men.
We're a country ruled, was it?
Oh, yeah, we are a country ruled by law. On the monument, it said, we are a country ruled by law, not men.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big difference, right? Because when the U.S. government, and of course governments of many Western countries, they're only in office for, you know, 2 years, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, and then there's a consistency between eras where, you know, you have new people, but they're there to uphold the laws that their predecessors have put in place, ideally through, you know, support of people who elected those people. Whereas in China, you can just have these radical different shifts in what's allowed and what's not allowed. And so it makes things really unstable because you have people being acting according to whim.
Well, I think also the problem in places like China under the Communist Party is that there might be laws like on the books, or there might be things like in China's constitution, it technically says you have freedom of speech.
Yeah,
right?
Article 35. I mean, it's very clear, freedom of speech.
But then they don't actually have any like power. So it's not rule by law, rule of law.
It's rule by law. In other words, now they're using the law to... crack down on people to, you know, Xi Jinping is using legal means to go after people for corruption, but he's just using the law essentially as a tool to go after his political enemies rather than it being everyone treated equally under the law.
It's selective.
Yes.
And also how what's considered politically correct switches often without people really realizing it. So you have people... in China, for example, people who are, you know, loyal to the Communist Party, like all the students in, or many of the students in Tiananmen, thinking, you know, they're loyal to the party, and then they find out that they're on the wrong end of the gun.
As Fang Zhen put it, you know, after the Tiananmen Square massacre, the political environment changed.
Understatement of the Year award.
Yeah, interestingly, China had more press freedom and freedom of speech in the mid to late 80s than it does now, or at any point after the Tiananmen Square massacre. Like, people were sort of, we had newspapers with different perspectives being published in China at the time. And yeah, you had people speaking their minds, and then it has never returned to pre-1989 levels.
I don't know about that. I mean, in China today, there are papers with different opinions. For example, you know, People's Daily will say the Diaoyu Islands belongs to China, and you'd have the Global Times saying the Diaoyu Islands belong to China, kill all the Japanese.
Well, yeah, that is a difference of opinion.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think with the Tiananmen Square student demonstrations, it really was, in a way, the last time that Chinese civil society really tried to rise up. Because we forget a lot of times that it wasn't just the students in Beijing. There were demonstrations across the country. There was like a secondary massacre in Chongqing that almost nobody talked about for more than 20 years.
It must suck to be in the lesser massacre that everyone glosses over.
Yeah, it was still pretty brutal. I think they brought a bunch of people into a hotel and then like just killed all of them.
Well, I don't think that was actually the last time something like that happened in China. I think in 1999, when you saw Falun Gong practitioners trying to appeal for their rights within the system, again thinking, you know, they're loyal to the Communist Party, they're part of the system, and then finding that, nope, that's not what it's going to be.
I mean, I guess you can say that there are people who have been trying to petition the government, like, through the years, and there's been, like, human rights lawyers trying to get the courts to actually, you know, uphold the laws. Like, they'll defend Falun Gong practitioners in court, or they'll try to defend human rights activists and be like, we just want you to follow what you say in the law. And, of course, then they get put in prison, too.
Yeah, well, you know, we talked about like the sort of whimsical
is a perfect word.
We talked about how things are done often at the whims of the people in power. And like Falun Gong is a really interesting example of that, because during the mid-90s, it was becoming really popular. And, you know, the Public Security Bureau invited Falun Gong's leader to like give a talk in one of their buildings. And Falun Gong was getting all these awards from the government and the state-connected China Qigong Science Research Society. And like all this praise, support. Government officials were saying, oh, it's going to save on healthcare costs when people do Falun Gong. And then, like, because the head of the Communist Party, Jiang Zemin, was like, I don't like it, make it illegal, right? And then just like a total shift. And that shift happened, almost overnight, or in the span of a few months. It went from, you know, being permitted to being like everyone's getting, you know, picked up by the police.
I think Shelley wants to.
I think it was at the time it seemed very sudden, and the predominant kind of narrative was that because Falun Gong protested in April of 1999, they like
10 years exactly from the start of the Tiananmen protests.
Oh, that's creepy in a way. Wow.
Yeah.
That they protested in front of the government compound in Zhongnanhai, that's what triggered the change toward Falun Gong. But then later researchers found out that you can look back and see that as far back as 96 and 97, they were already things like they started, you know, banning the printing of certain Falun Gong books, like certain.
But there were knockoffs because it was China.
Yeah, so the books were still out there. But then, you know, there were newspapers in different provinces that were starting to print some of the anti-Falun Gong propaganda that later became like predominant everywhere after the campaign against Falun Gong officially rolled out. So there were kind of beginning stages of these things that were happening even years in advance, or kind of government plainclothes police or spies were starting to infiltrate, you know, Falun Gong groups to try to, you know, figure out what was going on. So it's kind of became like retroactively people realized that it wasn't just a sudden shift in the government.
Yeah, no, it really only kind of appeared on the surface to be over the span of a few months. And you're right, but I think, though, the larger point I want to make, though, is there was a time during the mid-90s when Falun Gong was praised by the Communist Party and by the Chinese government. And then by late 1999, it was extremely dangerous and extremely illegal and all this propaganda. So even though the shift, you know, in reality maybe it took a few years, it's still like you don't have a situation in like America or in Europe or Canada or whatever, where like an organization is praised by the government, doesn't change, but then the government suddenly like turns on it and attacks it and starts arresting its members. Like that's not a thing.
I mean, let 100 flowers bloom, right?
Yeah, Mao's campaign to let intellectuals speak in the early 50s.
Yeah, we want your ideas, and now we're going to kill you for them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's the same with the Tiananmen students as well, where it seemed like they were marching because they felt like there was room within the party for some of these reforms, and there was a chance that the party leaders would listen to them. You know, and then the party leaders did meet with some of the student leaders and
yeah. Some of the leaders who were later purged.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Well, that's because then Deng Xiaoping decided on the hardline approach. So, yeah.
That's another understatement.
Yeah. I mean, a few years ago, I found these photos that my uncle had taken in Tiananmen Square of the protests that happened before the massacre. I had no idea he had them. I just found them in a shoebox that my parents had. And it was very, like, interesting for me to see, like, all of the students marching and, like, they look so hopeful. And then all these people marching who are not students, but, like, you know, this factory supports the students. Or the banner said, if there was even a banner that was like, the police, you know, support the students. And you got the sense that it was actually much bigger than just student, you know, protesters.
And am I right? I believe I remember hearing that the party had to send in the military from outside of the region because they couldn't get the soldiers from that area to shoot their own people.
Well, I mean, the first time they tried to send soldiers in, the people of Beijing actually turned them back. Like, they basically managed to convince the soldiers to not, like, enter the city. They, like, went out and, like, talked to the soldier or whatever, and they basically protected the students. And then the soldiers, like, left. And that's when they decided that they had to bring people in from far away, not tell them what was really going on, and, like, keep them isolated until they needed them to, you know, run their tanks over people.
Yeah. It's amazing because there was so much hope in, like, you know, May of that year. Those photos, actually, you put some of them on your blog, right? Let's put a link below the video. People can see some of those photos.
It's pretty interesting. Like, one of the ones that hit me the hardest was there's, you know, the people's monument in the middle of Tiananmen Square that's dedicated to revolutionary martyrs, and people had put all these signs on the monument, and one of them said, "The people will never forget 1989.
How ironic.
Oh my God. But they did, because that's what the Communist Party, like, dedicated everything to.
And now the situation is many young people have never heard of it.
I mean, I remember when I first visited Beijing, and this is 2002, there was a college student who was showing me around Beijing, and we were in an area on the Summer Palace area. There was, like, nobody around. And I was like, "So what do you think of the Tiananmen Square massacre?" Like, seeing if I could, like, stir up a conversation that was maybe partly forbidden. But I thought she just wouldn't want to talk about it. But she actually said, "What are you talking about?" you know, the Tiananmen Square massacre. She didn't know what I meant. I said, June 4th, 1989. She's like, oh, June 4th. You mean when the students attacked the soldiers? And I was like, I thought she was kidding, right? But she was not kidding.
Those jokesters.
Yeah, no, I mean, I couldn't believe that she didn't know. And then I was like, you know, you've lived in Beijing all your life. Like, your parents, like, they must know. Like, go ask your parents. I met up with her, like, a few days later. And she had asked her parents, who were both, like, doctors and intellectuals. And anyway, so they had never told her, but they were in Beijing at the time.
Did they then tell her?
They then did tell her. And she was just, like jaw-dropping shocked about what actually happened. And they had never told her whole life.
They were protecting her.
You stirred the pot, Matt.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did. And eventually this person left mainland China and moved to Hong Kong. I think appreciated the freedoms. Because she'd also spent a year or a few years in Boston. And she kind of like opened her up to seeing that, like, oh, wait, maybe there's more to, you know, China than the party line.
So what you're saying is you changed this girl's life by asking her about the Tiananmen Square massacre.
No, I didn't. But it was just interesting for me. And I did write her a recommendation letter.
I don't know. I kind of prefer the Matt changing lives story.
Me too.
Yeah, I do too.
Okay.
That's the way it's going to be then.
All right.
But it's interesting that her parents didn't tell her and then told her. It reminds me of this. I interviewed this woman many years ago who was a former Communist Party official, and she joined the party in the 80s. And then many years later, she became disillusioned with what she had to do as a party official. And her father, one day, who he was in his 80s, he like stripped and showed her his back, which was covered in burns, like scar tissue. And he like finally told her that it had happened during the Cultural Revolution, that like the Red Guards had like branded him with hot irons on his back. And she couldn't believe that he had hidden this from her her entire life, and like let her join the party and never told her any of it. And he was like, I just didn't want to, you know, I like kind of like force the next generation to relive the sins or something, you know. It was like he was trying to protect her in a way, but then like she felt like almost like betrayed, because, you know, she was like, my life might have been totally different if I had known what they did to you.
And we go back to trauma and how people deal with it.
Yeah, it can be quite intense, I guess.
Yeah, you know, and like, because in China, even though you've had these economic reforms that have gone from a communist economic system to a kind of, we can call it a capitalist system, roughly, like, the Communist Party has still been in charge the whole time. And so there hasn't been a kind of reconciliation with like what's happened in the past. So like in South Africa, when apartheid fell, there was this kind of reconciliation where people like talked about what happened to them. And there's this catharsis. Whereas, you know, and that's very healthy for a society to have the ability to talk about what happened in the past and what was wrong. And, you know, hopefully people can learn from history, which, you know, occasionally humans do. But in China, like, that's never been allowed to happen. And so people keep, they keep silent about all the things that they experienced. And it becomes kind of this, like, hidden national trauma.
What are you talking about, Matt? They're always talking about the horrible things Japan did to them in World War II.
And let's not forget the Opium War.
Oh, the Opium War.
Well,
colonialism.
You know, they did say that Mao was 30% wrong.
Was it 30 or 20? I'm pretty sure he was 80% right.
No, I think it's 70.
Yeah, Mao was 70% right and 30% wrong. And then Deng Xiaoping was like 60% right, 40% wrong. And then after that, no leader could use the percentages because it was just going to go downhill really fast.
Is that true about Deng Xiaoping? I didn't know that.
I don't know if he said that. I think that's just kind of a, that might have been like a joke people start to say.
Well, at any rate, you know, because if you continue at that rate, John would have been only 50-50 and Xi Jinping would be like 30-70, but the other way. So
it's a good thing he's president for life now, because we, any worse, it's really a good
thing. Well, he still would have to win re-election.
That's right. He's not president for life. It's just they eliminated term limits.
That's right.
So as long as he keeps getting reelected.
Well, now his best friend, Vladimir Putin, can teach him how it's done.
Oh, my gosh. How do we approach that?
Do we not want to talk about it?
No, I'm just, it's so funny. I don't know. I can't even process it. Okay.
Yeah, so Global Times released this video, and the text is, Chinese President Xi Jinping presents China's first friendship medal to Russian President Vladimir Putin. And actually, the footage is really hilarious. Global Times, which illegally uses a Twitter account, I guess, tweeted this video. And it's hilarious because both Xi Jinping, you know, Xi Jinping always has like a very like unreadable face, and Vladimir Putin is always kind of frowning. So they're both kind of doing this thing, and it's just...
They're standing next to each other. Vladimir Putin has this really gaudy-looking, like, gold necklace with a large medal at the end, which is the first Chinese friendship medal, I guess. And they both look deeply unhappy standing next to each other.
Well, there was footage of them riding a high-speed rail together, and I think, like, some of the conversations they were having were, like, about how romantic it is driving through the countryside.
Oh, man. Yeah, it was something like, one of them said, I always get a romantic feeling when I'm on a train.
I wonder which one it was.
I've only seen the subtitled version, so I didn't see the full video.
Yeah, I feel that's more of a Putin statement. You guys can disagree with me if you think that's a Xi Jinping statement.
I'm unclear if Xi Jinping has emotions. Like, his face is always the same.
Well, he is also dealing with trauma. He was sent to the countryside. His father, a revolutionary leader, wasn't he purged?
Oh, yeah. He had all sorts of trauma inflicted on him by the Chinese Communist Party. And then, as a youth, he joined the Communist Party and then became a leader.
Patiently waiting to become the leader.
I know, it's just, it's nuts to me. I don't understand, but, you know.
I don't know, though, with the Xi Jinping-Putin thing, do you think we're witnessing the birth of a beautiful new bromance?
100%.
See, I thought the bromance was supposed to be between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping.
I thought it was supposed to be Duterte, Putin, and Xi Jinping. Wasn't that his thing?
I guess all these strongmen rulers are just, you know, breaking down barriers between each other. Getting emotional. Men can be emotional with other men, Shelley.
Is it like a bromance retreat?
Yeah, isn't that basically what the North Korean summit's going to be? Kim Jong-un gets in there too.
Oh, man. There are so many strongman leaders.
Yeah, I don't think it's more than like historically there are. It just somehow seems like that. I mean, I guess the late 20th century seems like this, you know, a lot of countries were transitioning into democracy for the first time. But as we saw at the Oslo Freedom Forum, even in a democracy, sometimes you do end up with a strong man leader who then becomes authoritarian without really the people realizing that that's what's happening.
Which countries are you talking about?
Turkey. With Erdogan,
Cambodia,
Venezuela. So, you know, these are like democratically elected people who then, you know, deeply violate the rule of law or try to change what the laws are in order to give themselves more power. That seems like kind of a worrying thing. Although I'm not clear that the situation globally is worse now than it was. I mean, like, The 20th century was a much bloodier century than the 21st century so far.
Yeah, by all measures, the world is getting less violent, less warlike. It's really boring, right?
That's one way to look at it, Chris.
That's one way to look at it. Well, since we talked about Xi Jinping having his own trauma, I wonder how many of these strongman leaders, I wonder how many of them have their own heartache that they're just trying to work through.
Maybe they need some kind of catharsis.
Or some
MDMA drug.
That's the solution to all the problems.
Wow.
I just had a great idea for like a comedy sketch with all the strongman leaders like together in a kind of like a
group therapy.
Like group therapy, but like with, you know, beads and crystals and all this stuff, and they're trying to like, you know, deal with their trauma together, and there's like a shaman.
I think your Northern California roots are showing that.
That's true.
Are they also taking ayahuasca? They're having spirit quests?
Okay, imagine if Xi Jinping, Putin, Duterte, Erdogan, Kim Jong-un, you know, all got together and like...
Went to Burning Man.
No, this could actually potentially solve a lot of the world's problems. I refuse
to accept that Burning Man is a solution to anything.
I was going to say, or it could create a massive amount of new problems. So, like, you don't know. Like, you're really going to roll the dice with this one. But it would undeniably be interesting.
Yes, let's peel back the psyche of Vladimir Putin and let whatever in there out.
I just want to see Xi Jinping's festival attire.
Actually, you know, the real problem with Burning Man is a lot of people go naked, so...
Oh, my God.
This is a bad idea.
I mean, Putin would probably be okay with that.
He would probably, yeah.
I mean, yeah.
He's got the best bod of that bunch.
I feel like what we're rapidly approaching is the strongman calendar. Did we talk about this?
I think, yeah, because...
That wasn't a podcast.
There was the 2012 Onion article about Kim Jong-un being voted the sexiest man alive.
Yeah, this is happening, isn't it?
The strongman calendar. Yeah, no, I mean, it's I won't say it's a good idea, but it's an idea. And sometimes ideas don't have to be good to be put into action.
Let us know if you want us to make that strongman calendar.
Anyway, maybe we should move on.
Move on. Well, since one of the themes of all this was how people deal with trauma, I thought it was... very interesting, the talk given by Yongmi Park, a girl who escaped North Korea when she was a little girl with her mother and sister, got sold into, you know, sex slavery.
In China.
Had to escape to South Korea by going through this horrible desert pass where they carried razor blades and poison with them in case they got caught because they knew they'd had to kill themselves. And ultimately finds her way to the United States and is talking about how, like, all of her friends in New York are going to counseling every week. And she just talks about it. She's much happier now.
Well, I think she was just like, I've never been to therapy, but all of my friends have to go to therapy for, you know, all of their problems all the time.
Which is not to say that you don't have legitimate trauma to deal with, even if you are not... a North Korean defector.
Oh, that's true. She wasn't trying to belittle her friends, I think. She was just saying that she had a different perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that she's very grateful to not be in North Korea.
Or sex slavery in China.
Yeah. Yeah, she actually had a lot of interesting things to say about China. I mean, let us know in the comments below if you'd be interested in seeing an interview with her.
Yeah, that could be pretty cool.
So final thoughts and takeaway from the Oslo Freedom Forum?
When you are in a place where the sun doesn't set till 10:30 and it doesn't really get dark till midnight, you end up staying out really, really late and not getting much sleep. So by the end of the trip, I felt completely exhausted.
It was, in a way, more exhausting than Australia and New Zealand, even though we were only there for a week.
Yeah, a short forum, but there was no sleep, just all sun. I mean, I think by the end of it, I don't know what Matt was doing. I think he was blessing the rains down in Africa.
I mean, I kind of loved it at first, but then I was like, I couldn't live like this for like months. I don't know how people do it.
Oh, great. We're getting vitamin D. And then it was like, too much vitamin D. It's manic.
And also, like, not eating dinner until 10 o'clock was also kind of just like, you just feel like you've got to, like, work all day and into the night.
Which was very convenient for the busyness of the forum itself. Shelley, your final thoughts and takeaway from the Oslo Freedom Forum?
That the world can be a terrible place, but there are lots of people who are trying to do something about it. And also, it's definitely blessed the rains down in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know what? We're some of those people trying to make a good change.
Be the change you want to see in the world.
This is an uplifting and dramatic episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's thematically appropriate.
Perfect. And with that uplifting and crushing note, thanks for listening to this podcast of China Unscripted. Once again, I am Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganeshda.
All right, Chris, take us out with Africa.
I bless the rains down in Africa. There's nothing that 100 men or more could ever do.